I'm going to ask that you turn. I'm going to read several passages of Scripture. I'm not going to read the whole of 1 Corinthians 7. For one, it's a little bit lengthy, but for the other, it is actually that I don't want to think of all, deal with all of the verses. But what I want to do, like a typical catechetical style sermon that is in some sense topical, I want to read the couple of passages of Scripture that we'll be considering. So first, if you would turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, I'm going to read verses 1 through 5, and then I'm going to read towards the end verses 33 and 34, and then we'll turn to a couple of other places. So let's begin to hear the word of the Lord. 1 Corinthians 7, Paul writes, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, quote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, unquote. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Now, towards the end, verses 33 and 34. "But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband." And then turn to Colossians chapter 3, and I'll read verses 18 through 21. And then we'll move forward. The Apostle Paul writes there, "Wives, submit to your husbands, as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives, and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." And we will end there, and I'll probably refer to a few other passages, but those are the main ones that we'll be considering tonight. As we look at, and as I've been introducing this, the sub-points of man's chief end, here glorifying God in marriage. To remind you, we won't all say it today because I want to move forward, but we're sort of dealing in a sub-way with the first catechism question, what is the chief end of man? Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. I want to pull the string on the all things, do all things to glorify God from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31, which is a proof text for that main catechism answer. And I want us to, under the category of all things, consider some of the all things. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at piety, so our walk with the Lord as a way of glorifying God. Today, marriage, Lord willing, in a couple of weeks, when I come back again to preach in the evening, it will be on work, and then we will move on to question number two. So with that kind of introduction, I want us to think about glorifying God in marriage in a couple of different ways. First, as properly fulfilling your roles as a husband and wife. Secondly, as demonstrating sanctification to one another. And then I'm going to say this, because this is where my points are going to revolve around, not thinking more highly or lowly of marriage than you ought. At times, I think we make it this ideal in a way that makes folks who are not married suffer needlessly. And so I want us to make sure that we don't think more highly nor more lowly than we thought, than we ought. And so my two points tonight are actually going to be that. Firstly, My first main point is going to be marriage is more earthy than you think. And then my second point is going to be marriage is more heavenly than you think. So marriage is more earthy than you think, and marriage is more heavenly than you think. And so the first point that I want to make, marriage is more earthy than you think, is I want us to just do that quick run through the scriptures. What is marriage? Where does it come from? I want to say up front that Jesus has some things to say about marriage, one of which is that he confirms that marriage is for this age only. It is not for the age to come, where he tells them that you will not be marrying and giving in marriage as you are here. And so we recognize this as an earthy thing, and that's why I'm using that word. But marriage, as you know, hopefully was created, instituted maybe, in Genesis chapter 2, where God brings Adam and Eve together, and he properly orders marriage as between one man and one woman. The Westminster Confession of Faith gives, I'm going to say three reasons. I think most of you would say four reasons, but I'm going to combine two of them. It says that marriage is for, firstly, mutual help. And it references the passage in Genesis 2 as to why Eve was given to Adam, that she would be a help meet, I think some translations use, to Adam. So it's for mutual help, though, they say. And I would agree with that, that it's not just one person being served and helped, but it's a mutual help to one another. Then, secondly, they say it's to propagate, they don't say it this way, but to propagate the species, to have more children, to have children, to advance humanity. They add to that, and I'm going to say to an extent, the church. Yes, we add it to the church. We have to be careful because we add people who are believers technically to the church. In the visible church membership, believers and their children, but you're not an automatic lifelong member of the church without a profession of faith. So we just want to make sure I add that in there. But we propagate humanity, and then to that extent, we add to the church. And then thirdly, in my view there, not fourthly, but we avoid fornication, and it uses the passage here in 1 Corinthians 7 that we just read about the conjugal rights of a husband and wife. And so they themselves there in at Westminster Divines, and I pointed this out in Sunday school this morning, they view marriage as a very earthy matter. And what I mean by that is that you can see here that they don't give us any high philosophical views of marriage, at least not yet. What they start with is, when we look around, or what does the Bible say, it says marriage is for this age of this earth, and it includes these things. Mutual help, children, and then avoiding sin. So sanctification, maybe we could put it positively. But while created in the Garden of Eden, it is not, and I'm going to reference this, okay, so I'm going to say it like this. We are not Roman Catholic. Marriage is not a sacrament. All right, so I'm going to say that. I'm going to say that clearly because I get this sometimes. I hear this in places. Marriage is not a sacrament. For something to be a sacrament, it would not only have to be instituted by Christ, but it would have to be only for the church. That's what we say. Baptism is for the church. Believers bring their children, or those who make professions of faith are baptized, if never been baptized. And the Lord's Supper is particularly for those who discern the body. Right, so it is for the church. That's what makes it a sacrament. Marriage is not a sacrament because it is for everybody. We actually see this in Genesis 8 and 9, where after the flood, God makes a covenant with the entire world, with Noah, his sons, and all living things, we're told. And twice in there, Noah and his sons are told to be fruitful and multiply. I don't presume it was for Noah. He was not only quite old, but it's not recorded that he has more children after that. But in fact, it was for his sons to be fruitful and multiply. And just to pull that string a little bit, Ham is quite the unbeliever. And yet he is obviously married and he has children. So it is what we would call a common grace institution. It is for all people, not just for believers. All right. So in our world, for better or worse, the state controls marriage, controls in the sense that it defines it, it gives you the license to marry and all that kind of stuff. That's who does it. And it's a common grace, and that would not be unusual that it would be that way. But it's a common grace, common to all type of institution. All right. In fact, it would behoove us to encourage people to be married. And what I mean by that is people who desire to have children, to live together, that kind of thing. We should encourage them to be married. That would be, at least as a minimum, obeying to a certain degree God's law for how it is that we were to be together in that way. So nonetheless, it is a common institution for all. So it is earthy in that way. It is part of this created order, and it is for certain things in this created order. The earthiness of marriage, though, as believers particularly, we are to be glorifying God. And so how is that to be done? And so I laid out a couple of ways in the introduction. And so what I want to start with is there in 1 Corinthians 7, what I would deem as, and when I taught this, I said this, that verse 1 in chapter 7, I said quote unquote, because not all translations do it this way, but I want us to recognize that where it says in verse 1, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. I think that what Paul is doing is quoting the Corinthians who wrote to him and said, hey, is this true, or this is what we're doing, or something along those lines. And now he's quoting it back to them, and he's going to refute it. No, that's actually not true. And their problem is a Gnostic problem. Mostly the denial of the inherent goodness of creation, or in their view, the inherent evil of creation. So matter, all things that were matter, were inherently evil, and such the desire was to shed themselves of any material part, which would be include your body, and thus you would want to reach a state in which you are purely spiritual. So if you notice all throughout Corinthians, he deals with this idea of spirituality. And he deals with it in a couple of ways, but one of them is to remind them that they are embodied souls, that they are not spirit beings. And in that, he deals with, if you will, maybe I should have put a PG-13 label on this sermon tonight and had, I don't know, everyone under 21 leave or something. But he puts it right down into, like, right out of the gate, sex between a husband and wife. Okay, so just to remind you all that you're not pure spirit beings, and that your marriage matters, and that it matters in a particular way, it matters in that way. So he lays it out there to say, here's how earthy your marriage is, and by denying this thing that God has created to your marriage partner, you're actually being unspiritual, not spiritual. Right. So that's how he does that. And for the Gnostics, they could go either licentious or ascetic, and Corinth had kind of a little bit of both. They had the people that were very licentious in their sexuality. In this case, it was the people that wanted to be ascetic. Let's not have any sexuality in marriage at all. All right. So 1 Corinthians 7:1 captures the Corinthians' thought that Paul is going to refute. They thought giving up conjugal rights to spouses made them more spiritual. Paul says, no, it's just the opposite. Actually, he says, you know, what it's going to do is it's going to lead you to sin. But you're going to end up in fornication, which we know that they were doing. Some of them were visiting temple prostitutes. Some of them were doing all sorts of heinous sexual perverted things. And so he says, so if you're married, take care of business. Otherwise, you're going to lead to worse things, which is, you know, this kind of fornication. So he refutes this in a couple of ways. First, he says man is created, and by implication, he says, with these sexual desires properly fulfilled in marriage. So that's where it's properly fulfilled, and that they need to be properly expressed there. So the negative side is then you prevent your spouse from sinning. But the second way he refutes this idea, this Gnostic idea, is that, and This will be a shout out or a smackdown or something for all of the everyone who's thought that the only piece of advice for marriage is wives submit. That's what I heard growing up. That was the only one piece of advice, right? He says, well, I have news for you. Woman, wife, you have authority over your husband's body. Husband, you have authority over your wife's body. And he uses the word exousia. It is a word that is translated often in the New Testament as authority, so the ability to do something, the right, if you will, and the power to do it. So, in other words, what he's saying is you no longer belong to yourself. You no longer live to satisfy and gratify yourself only. Actually, in a true loving relationship, you are now there to satisfy and gratify your spouse in the most intimate way. That's what he says. That is glorifying God in marriage. It is recognizing that you give up the rights to yourself because now you are one flesh with someone else. And in the doing of that, that is proper and thus glorifying to God. Because we said all the way back that glorifying God, we put it under the headings of knowing Him, of obeying Him, and of serving Him. And so it's interesting to me that whenever man gets involved, sinful man gets involved with good ideas, they're like 100% wrong all the time. Like this, how can you, you pull the average person, how could you be more spiritual? They're going to tell you, be ascetic. Give up your material goods. Give up, maybe this kind of intimate sexual relations. Give it all up. Give all that up and you will be more spiritual. And Paul says, nope, that's not the right answer. He says, no, actually, you were created in a very particular way. And this proper expression is actually glorifying to God. Because otherwise, you're going to be led into sin. So he doesn't even just leave it as a neutral category. He says, it's a category in which if you get this wrong, the potential exists that you're going to fornicate, commit adultery, abandonment. I mean, all of that is there. So we want to make sure that we understand where true spirituality lies. That is, spirituality in the sense of glorifying God properly or being a godly person. So this becomes then a common source of strife. You have a spouse that is essentially Gnostic, desiring spirituality but denying earthly conjugal rights. And you end up with the wrong thing. You end up with sin and not glorifying of God. Right, so you would aid, if you will, in your spouse's sanctification with proper intimacy. So I'm going to say this. This is not something that we just only think of it in one way. So however it is that you would properly express your intimacy in wherever you are in the stage of marriage, that's what is proper. What Paul is talking about particularly is just the outright denial of it, either verbally saying it or just not even participating. So he's very clear about how it is that we can be spiritual. The second way that marriage is earthy, and that was the fun one, the second way that marriage is earthy is the second set of verses that I read. And actually, I want to read verse 28 as well. So 1 Corinthians 7, verse 28, which says the same thing as verses 33 and 34. But Paul writes, "But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you of that." So part of Paul's argument in 1 Corinthians 7 is there's some impending disaster, and he's saying maybe until this all clears up, maybe we should think about marriage in a different way. But what I want to say is that, but generally he says this, each spouse should properly ordered be thinking of worldly things. He says that in verses 33 and 34 as well. Worldly things, yes. Worldly things here, he means things like food and clothing and shelter. And in other words, he says, if you're married, you as a husband should be preoccupied with serving your wife in a way that you are concerned for her shelter, her food, the basic things that she needs daily, your children as well. And if you're a spouse, then you're thinking of that the same way. So in other words, this is a little bit anachronizing to do it this way, but it's like basically Paul is saying you need to think about working and providing for your spouse. You need to worry about taking the kids to their soccer practice or to their dance lessons. You need to be concerned about making sure the grass is cut or, whatever it happens to be. In other words, the things that go towards a happy home, the worldly things, those should concern you because those concern your spouse. It's not what we want to hear. Because what we want to all do, I shouldn't say this, what some people want to do, a few of you, maybe, I don't know, out there in the broad Christian world, we want to aestheticize ourselves to think that by serving God, that only means being in ministry. Paul says, no, by serving God, you're going to do what you were created to do in the roles that you were created to be as a husband or a wife or a child or a father or mother, those things. And he says, you would best glorify him when you're doing that. That's when you will be glorifying him, God. So this also leads to a common source of strife. Because we tend to want to ignore these things, again, most of the time for purely selfish and self-gratifying reasons. We just want to do the things that bring us pleasure. And so we ignore the other stuff. All right. That was the hard part, I guess, or the fun part or something. The second point I want to make is that marriage is more heavenly than you think. And this goes to our passage in Colossians. And, of course, the one we didn't read, but I'll just mention in Ephesians chapter 5. That's the one that everyone likes, the one that everyone turns to. But it is not the only one that the scriptures have anything to say about marriage. But it is very important there. But marriage is more heavenly than you think. And I'm going to start this by saying that it's heavenly because of what Paul says in Colossians chapter 3, verse 1. That in your sanctification, you are united to Christ and seated with him. So that your sanctification flows out of your being seated with him in a heavenly place. So that you are heavenly minded. So that when he then unloads on us the rest of those verses about putting off and putting on and putting away anger and putting on love and being forgiven, that as Christian spouses, particularly, so this is for all Christians, but as Christian spouses, we are to think in terms of being heavenly. How heavenly can you and I be as spouses? It would be demonstrated in how much we are pursuing our own sanctification. That's what it would be. That we would be preferring one another in love, not seeking our own way. So in other words, as you are being sanctified, which you know, a spouse really aids in the process, right? That as you are being sanctified, that those things are being demonstrated first and foremost before your spouse. Before the whole watching world, before us here at the church, before the, if you work, you know, there, if you're in school, you know, whatever. But it's demonstrated first and foremost before your spouse. That would be a good determinant as to how heavenly that you actually are. When we think about our sanctification in relation to our marriage. And so, yes, Paul then goes on to say that the roles that husbands and wives play, that husbands are to love their wives and wives are to submit to their husbands. Here in Colossians, he uses a passive verb that they are to be submissive. And I've made the case before that I think that this is a voluntary subjection in the same way that we submit ourselves to Christ when we become Christians in this way. He gives us a new heart. He gives us faith. We humble ourselves before him. In that way, wives subject or submit themselves to their husbands. Knowing that the husband is the head and that the wife properly takes the role submitting to him. And that's always glorious to all the husbands, but I think their job is harder, to be honest with you. Maybe that's just because I am one. But husbands, you are to love your wives, which is the most non-self-gratifying thing that you will ever do. Hands down, across the board, the case. And I, including myself, I would imagine every man here who's a husband has failed once or twice or 10,000 times. But you are to love your wives or your wife. So each husband is to love his wife. You know, that famous agape kind of love, the self-sacrificial, self-giving love that Paul tells us in Ephesians is the kind of love that Christ had for his own bride, the church. That he gave himself up for her to sanctify her, to make her holy. That is the kind of love that you should have. I said this one other time when we were dealing particularly with the Colossians passage, that an exhaustive study shows that no woman ever shot her husband while he was doing the dishes. Just to give a little levity there to the tense nature of our subject. But then he goes on to say, don't be harsh. Don't be bitter. Don't act with a heart of bitterness. Because your authority as a husband is derivative from God and is not to be acted out in harshness. It's not to be angry, it's not to be acted out selfishly, angrily, or tyrannically. That's not the kind of the authority that God rules us with. It is not the kind that we are to rule, if you will, our wives with. And so to love one's wife then is to simply put her interests ahead of yours. And so be heavenly minded in your spouseness in terms of both the sanctification that you exhibit and the understanding of the roles that you have. So that then we can finally come around to Ephesians chapter 5, the very famous and well-known passage where we are told that Christ is the head of the church and the church submits to him. That Christ loved the church by giving himself to her to make her holy. And then Paul says, thus a man should leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. Behold, I tell you a mystery. That this interplay between Christ and the church and a husband and wife, one stands for the other and one represents the other. And so you want to have a marriage that properly reflects the scriptures. Have one that properly reflects Christ loving the church, who is properly submitted to her, cleaving to him as husband, the source, the head, the provider. So let me conclude. So let your marriage, if you are married, glorify God. If you are not, and you're waiting to be, or it's in, you know, you want to be, prepare yourself to be the proper husband or wife. Thinking through the idea of what it means to be sanctified and heavenly minded in that way. And how it is that you would act as wife or husband. And mostly consider the earthiness of marriage. That it is for this age. It is for the most mundane and practical of things. Wonderful things. The propagation of the species, to put it in a weird biological technical term. To have children. To avoid sin, to be a mutual help to one another. Then I think your marriage will reflect that high mystery of marriage. Christ loving the church who submits to him. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we give you thanks for your word to us. And I pray that for all of us here, for the married folks, that we would hear your word speak to us, for the unmarried, desiring to be, soon to be, in the throes of. Help us, Lord, to prepare ourselves to be good spouses. And for those who are, may we receive your word with gladness and joy. And I pray all these things through Christ. Amen. We're going to stand.